It's a freedom machine like no other. Starting, growing, and cashing out of your own business.
Then all hell breaks loose.
Burned out, carrying all the weight on your shoulders, fighting fire after fire, never getting a break.
But that was so yesterday.
It's time for your business breakthrough. Break out of the bottleneck. Break through to new levels of success. And break into a life you love. Now from Park Avenue in New York City, here's attorney, strategist, and SBA small business champion, Nina Kaufman. This is the Business Breakthrough Podcast.
Hello, how are you? Welcome to Business Breakthrough. I'm your host, Nina Kaufman, coming to you from the heart of New York City, and I'm glad you're here today. Thanks for tuning in. In this episode, we're going to chat with Jonathan Blessing. He's an entrepreneur and software engineer about how do you balance responsibility and authority. Really, when you're building and growing and wanting to bring on a team, they've got to have a space in between the two, the responsibility to do the work that needs to get done, but the authority to make decisions in the event that things come up and it's not exactly as you thought. Now, we get a little conceptual in this episode. I'll give you a fair warning disclaimer, but there is both an art and a science to creating a team that works well together. And that's part of what Jonathan and I are going to talk about today. That's also something we touch on in our special report, 10 Steps to a $1 Million Business. If your workforce isn't working, all roads end up leading back to you, which is, you know, let's face it, it's the exact opposite result that you wanted, that you thought was going to happen when you said, okay, I'm ready to grow by hiring the talents of others. So as you listen to this episode, again, we're going to touch on how do you manage a team that may have different work styles and some of whom prefer to work independently? And how can you, yes, create systems and accountability, but also leave the space and the flexibility to allow people to have their own work styles and focus on the results? So that's why I'm looking forward to talking with Jonathan this week. Now, a little bit about him. Jonathan Blessing is the CEO of Ceres Digital, and he brings 16 years of experience delivering solutions to long-standing challenges in software development and the design of information systems. His areas of expertise include information modeling, database design, and systems integration. And he has personally supported clients like Department of Defense, the New York Times, Sony Classical, the Department of Justice, and Goldman Sachs, just to name a few. And supported by an expert team of developers and designers, he's focused on building Ceres Digital into a client-centric software consulting firm with a commitment to delivering software that is beautiful in appearance, obvious in function, and long-lasting. Sounds like a scalable approach to me. And we're delighted to have him here on Business Breakthrough. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for being here today.
Hello, Nina. Thank you.
I'm eager to talk to you because you have a wonderful story of going from consultant to business partner to now having, it's about 8 employees. Is that right?
We're 6 full-time employees and 4 contractors.
Okay. So 6 full-time, 4 contractors. Certainly bigger than solo. So I wanted to hear a little bit about what are some of those factors that made you really ready to grow the business instead of staying where you were, which would have been easy to stay as a consultant.
In some days, I miss it.
Truth be told.
I don't know if, precisely what made me ready or if I was ever ready, but I know what I wanted and still do want. So I think, you know, some of the things that kind of came together in my mind that provided the desire to go from just kind of being myself and a contractor or myself and a just, you know, a small group to a proper firm. One, I wanted to retain the people that I was working with. And when you're small, when you're really just kind of a 1 or 2 or 3 person shop, it limits the size of the projects that you can work on.
Mm.
Okay. And that not just limits the size of the projects, it also limits the diversity of the projects, and it limits the roles that people can have. So there isn't sufficient diversity to kind of keep people around, keep them interested, and help them grow. So having more people on staff, more engineers, more designers, means we can go after a greater diversity of projects So yeah, it makes work more interesting for people. It means that lead engineer on a project today could perhaps, you know, maybe manage the next project instead of just code. So it makes work a little bit more interesting, I think.
Great. And so in addition to making the work interesting, was there something in terms of just having a vision for either the larger projects or the way you could be of greater service to the clients that you wanted to reach to that was also part of that equation?
Certainly. So a lot of the things we build, we end up supporting. And I think the longest project for which we provided support was maybe 7 years.
Oh my.
And yeah. So 7 years, right? You know, you build this thing and you build it for a client, and the client's business grows and is essentially dependent on it. It's a critical part of their day-to-day operations. And to provide them with service, good service, you need to be more than one or two people. Because when something comes up, when an urgent matter arises, you know, the client reasonably desires to have expeditious treatment.
Sure.
So it's certainly by having more hands on deck means that we can provide greater coverage. You know, and for myself too, I also wanted to have this kind of diversity in roles and projects. And so I also get to enjoy this. It's not just for my colleagues.
Great. And can you just drill down without sharing any secret sauce or confidential stuff? Just describe a little bit, what was that 7-year project? How did it start? And then how did it build into the support function? What exactly did you do?
Oh, yeah, sure. So, goodness, that was a long time ago. I think it was 2009, 2008. I think we were first approached by someone who had kind of, he had gone out on his own and he wanted to build. Really, he was basically an entrepreneur, and he wanted to build a firm that would help basically provide outside research for hedge fund, private equity, investment banks, and to provide that research, he needed to basically, you know, to facilitate the connecting of, say, the analyst with the expert. And so that meant, you know, talking to a lot of people. And the only way to do this efficiently is through automation. And so he had in mind a very specific thing that he wanted to build. And so we built it for him. And then, you know, we built it for him and it went really well. So he then retained us to keep building it and keep expanding it to the point where it kind of covered his entire business. I mean, the whole surface of his business was reflected in the software and supported by the software.
Wow. Great. So yeah. Thank you. If I remember correctly, you went on vacation recently.
Yeah,
and
that was great.
The first time in a long time. So,
well, it was the first time in about a year. Yeah, and to clarify, it was vacation with children. So it's really, you know, it's I don't know. I think maybe it was more work than work.
But being able to at least be there for the kids, so the kids can have a vacation while you work in a different capacity, means that you need to be able to let things go back in the office. So there's a balancing act between responsibility and authorities. Can you talk a little bit about, as you have expanded, how have you been able to strike that happy balance between sharing tasks without being too much of an ogre and standing over people's shoulders micromanaging them?
Well, I would like to think that I'm not regarded as a micromanager, but you know, I think that, I mean, that really was one of the motivations that I had for kind of growing the business, and you know, was to make it something that was apart from myself, much more apart from myself as possible. So, you know, 18 months ago, when we kind of set out on this journey to really make the business bigger and to kind of separate it from its founder, me, that, you know, in my mind, I had vacations as an objective for this.
Good.
So, yes, took one. It was nice. I don't know that there's an easy answer to your question. So, you know, most of our business, one of our chief services, one of our principal services is building software for people. It's to kind of realize someone's idea as software. And for a lot of the projects, there's an enormous amount of responsibility. You know, if we're, say, integrating a portfolio and trading management system, as we are for one of our clients, through which, billions of dollars a day will travel. And the challenge of building something like this is very exciting. And the requirements, though, are demanding because there's an expectation that it will never fail. not only will it never fail, but it will, it will have a lifespan of, say, a decade. Now, think about the software like that you use, in your own life. And do you have any expectation of any of it lasting a decade?
Good Lord, no.
Yeah. No. And so, when we sit down to begin engineering a solution like this, whoever the lead developer on a project like this needs to know that not only do they have this responsibility, but they have sufficient authority to kind of bring to bear the resources required to engineer the solution to the client's specification. So if that means it takes 2 or 3 months just to develop the specification, well, that's what's required for building something that cannot fail and needs to run for 10 years.
It reminds me of that. There's a lovely scene in the film Amadeus. I don't know if you ever saw it with Tom Hulce and
Lovely movie. Yeah.
And where Mozart is standing in front of the King of Prussia and he's just finished his minuet in G or whatever it is. And the king is looking at him saying, it was very lovely, but it's just too many notes. And Mozart says, but sire, it has no more and no fewer notes than I require. So that cadence reminded me of what you were saying is the spec process takes whatever it takes. It takes no more, no less than you require to achieve that ultimate success for the project and for the client.
Well, Nina, I'm flattered for the heady comparison with Mozart.
Right.
It's sometimes difficult to tell a client, to tell somebody that really wants a thing, that thing that they want is going to be hard and it's going to be demanding. And I think one of the things that I'm constantly trying to do better is to ensure that, my colleagues know that it's a good thing to tell, to speak truthfully to clients if they ask for something which may not be as simple as they think they are. So if a thing really is going to take a month to build or 2 months or a year, they don't need to hide that they should be upfront and...
Oh, sure. And as a lawyer, I am well aware that if I tell a client that something is going to go through a certain process or it's going to take 3 weeks to do a turnaround or a negotiation, because I'm afraid that the client will either go elsewhere or they're going to be upset. They're going to be a lot more upset when the process takes three times as long and is three times as expensive as they already anticipated. And they kind of feel like you've duped them by roping them in with false expectations at the outset. So I agree with you. That kind of transparency is really important.
Yeah. And then I think, I'm trying to put this as articulately as I can to kind of bring it to a point. And that, it isn't easy to... even for myself, to often feel like I have the authority, that the relationship between authority and responsibility is at parity, because there needs to be parity for these things. Because if you invest someone with a lot of responsibility but insufficient authority, well, it's just not going to happen. It's just he or she won't be able to do that thing. And yes, maybe this has kind of drifted into the abstract a little too much, but so it's something I'm trying to give more thought to, more concrete thought to, is when we begin a project, to ensure that the kind of the responsible parties, the lead engineers on the project, feel like they have the resources and the authority to bring in more resources, whatever is necessary to do it and to do it right. And I guess there are kind of two areas where this seems most apropos. One is, it's at the outset of an engineering project, and the other is just long-term client relations. So when you're supporting a piece of software for, say, 7 years, the people on our side need to know, the people that the client deals with, me or what, someone else here, needs to appreciate that not only do we have this great responsibility of supporting the software, but we have the authority to take care of the client. And this gets back to kind of scaling the business, and sometimes that authority doesn't need to involve me.
Right. And that's a really good point. So as you're delegating, and let's see if we can find a concrete example. You've delegated, let's say, the support of the software to various members of your team. How do you know when that balance is out of whack? And I would think that it's usually that too much ends up coming back onto your plate. So can you give an example of when that
happened
and how you recalibrated it so that it functioned better?
Emails and IMs, right? Okay. If I begin to feel like I'm being asked for permission or clarification on matters which I don't feel especially expert on, which often require that I kind of step into a situation and kind of understand it as an insider, then that's often an indication to me that I haven't been there to invest my colleagues with, you know, the authority that they probably rightfully need in order to take care of whatever they need taken care of. So the very fact that I might get pestered by, like a simple thing like purchasing infrastructure to support a project. You know, if somebody needs to purchase some infrastructure, I probably don't need to be asked for permission to make that, you know, to put through that expense if it's going, you know, directly to support a client.
Mm-hmm. But aren't there some parameters? When you say purchasing infrastructure, usually what kind of price point are you talking about? Because, you know, an employee might say, well, if it's $50, not a big deal. If it's $5,000, you know, maybe the client might want to give some prior approval. So
like with like. So if we're working on a modest project, you know, and if it's in the statement of work that the modest project is going to require a modest amount of infrastructure, then the expectations have already been set that, you know, to build this piece of software, you know, we're going to need to purchase maybe $200 or $300 worth of infrastructure every month, hosting, say. And sometimes this gets back to whether or not I've done a good job in terms of setting expectations initially with the client as to what they can expect as the engineering process unfolds.
Right. And it also sounds like there's a certain amount of transparency you need with your staff and the people to whom you're delegating as well, to be able to say, all right, this is the scope of the project. It's modest. And this is not the time for you to go ka-ching on somebody else's dime.
Like truly one of the ways in which I'm fortunate, and I like to think my colleagues are fortunate, there's an enormous amount of transparency across the board, throughout the company on a project. And I guess when you're doing work like we're doing, it's hard. So, I mean, software is one of these strange things. You know, I don't know what other part of the economy, large part of the economy, is still reliant on a handmade thing.
Mm.
And if you think, I mean, it's kind of miraculous that as much of it is made as is made, and it works as well as it does. Because it's entirely handmade, and it is often the case that a lot of software is just built from other software. But most of our projects are, from the ground up, are custom software projects. And for our engineers to do the great job that we expect them to do, they really need to understand as much as can be understood about the client's business and about all aspects of the project.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, and I watched The Big Bang Theory, so I know a lot about software engineers. And what I do know is that they often like to work independently. It's not like, rah, rah, hey, we're a football team and we're all together and 1, 2, 3, hop. It's that they may be off in their silos or working independently, working at odd hours. How do you manage a team?
I haven't seen this TV show.
Oh.
I'm familiar with it, but I haven't seen it. The TV show that I have been watching, which I think does a pretty good job of portraying one part of kind of the software culture, is Mr. Robot.
Hmm.
Which I think it's a very good show. Yes, software developers are like cats. It's and I count myself among them. You know, I mean, my own background is a technical one. Yeah,
you raise your tail and you ignore me. Is that what that is?
Kind of. You know, it's they don't give love easily. They don't follow. You know, it's respect and liberty, I think, is what it comes down to. You know, so in our industry, if you hire a good engineer, that means you need to give that person the kind of the respect that they've earned, you know, along the way of developing their trade. So, you know, even if you disagree with some of the decisions that that person might make at times, you have to at least hear them out. And you have to give them the liberty of experimenting and of learning. I mean, part of what makes a good nerd is, you know, after they've done their work, they often go, you know, like in the evenings, they're reading about software. And they really want to, you know, it's kind of exciting, a lot of the things that are that kind of happen in our industry. And to the extent that we can, and it's a good fit, we like to bring in new technologies.
Okay. So talk a little bit about those technologies and how that helps you stay efficient as you grow and ideally you scale.
I thought a little bit about this, and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to kind of reinforce the point that software still is a really, it still is a handmade thing. Mm-hmm. And developing efficiencies, I don't think there are efficiencies of scale. And okay. I don't think that, not in the way that there are with manufacturing, that there is with manufacturing. I think that there are efficiencies to be gained from experience and intelligence. So we, as much as possible, if we're beginning a project that looks like an older project, we'll try to bring together the team that did that older project.
Okay.
Because that the new project will benefit from lessons learned on the previous project. Mm-hmm. And that's a way where our company, being larger than it was 18 months ago, is able to work faster and better, because we're doing more projects and there's a lot of similarity. So if you see something that looked like a project 6 months ago, if you're beginning on a new project that's not too different from an old one, chances are that you'll be able to reuse a lot of the experience.
Okay.
And there is a narrower point to make that, you know, a lot of the developments in software are really about making the building of software easier. And as much as possible, we try to benefit from that, those evolutions.
Sure. Well, the same way in the legal industry, technology has provided a lot of opportunity to be a lot more efficient in terms of, let's say, drafting a document, that we don't have to write it out with a quill pen anymore. Or a typewriter, or I'm dating myself. I remember carbon paper.
And word perfect. My understanding is that lawyers really miss word perfect.
I'm okay with word. I guess I've gotten used to it. But even so, but yeah, just that, you know, not having to type everything over from scratch again. Absolutely, there are, as you say, a lot of efficiencies from being able to build on what was created previously. So if I have created the wording to the perfect confidentiality agreement, and that's something that I think all of my clients should be using, then it's a lot easier for me to share that information with a lot of different people than it was before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, if we've written really good connection pooling software, you know, which is a common, you know, there are a lot of problems that you end up solving over and over in software. And some of these solutions are open sourced and they're just out there. And part of having experience with the development of software means you're just familiar with them. And, you know, instead of spending a week working on it, on the problem, or a week looking for a solution, you know, in a minute, you know where to go and get it. Mm-hmm. And that's just something that comes naturally from experience.
Great. And can you share some of the platforms? You know, you mentioned you have sometimes a dispersed team that, you know, not everyone is sitting right in front of you in the same room all the time. And people do like to work at odd hours. What are some of the platforms you use to make sure that everyone on a particular project remains on the same page, if you will?
It depends on the project. And you're right, too. I mean, so it's interesting. So our designers, so we have a nice design practice. Our designers are much more inclined to, you know, be in the office together, whereas the developers and the engineers really don't know that they care to see each other so much. They're very involved with one another on IM, but, you know, the act of, you know, coming into the office, I guess, is just such a gross inefficiency that there, yes. See them much, but they exist. So it really depends on the project. For large development projects, we'll use a project management tool called Jira. And for smaller ones, we'll use one called Trello.
All right,
and Trello is something which is definitely popular outside of the software world. It's, you know, for people, for kind of list makers and list takers. I think there's a role for Trello to play in your lives.
Oh, I love lists. So yes, absolutely.
Yeah, Trello. I still use graph paper and a pen, but.
Right. But not everybody else is able to share in that, especially if you know that you have milestones or deadlines for particular aspects of the project that need to be shared. Yeah, the graph paper doesn't always do it.
No, it doesn't. And I think, you know, just project management tools are, you know, I regularly get together with friends who kind of occupy similar positions in similar companies. And, you know, one of the things we do is we gripe about project management tools that there's just no one has yet to make a great general purpose tool.
Mm-hmm.
At least no one that we know of.
Okay. And last question, in terms of knowledge transfer, again, because you do have people working from different places and in different aspects of it, how do you make sure that there is that repository for knowledge in the event that you do end up bringing on or an employee leaves or the composition of the team changes with new contractors?
Yeah, and this is truly among the motivations for growing the company was to ensure kind of greater resilience of knowledge. And there's one of the decisions we made about 18 months ago was to move to kind of a standard development language and framework. And so what this ensures is, you know, for the most part, all of the software we built is built using the same tools. So ideally, you know, one engineer can understand another engineer's work. And that's important. That helps ease, you know, helps ensure high throughput of knowledge transfer. And then the other area where we often carry a lot of specialized information is, you know, it's about the client, their business requirements, the intricacies of their operations. And that's one of the most difficult bodies of knowledge to move around. There's no doubt about it. Because in order to build software which really is supportive of our clients' businesses, that solves their problems and improves their efficiencies, we need to understand their business really well. And clearly we all can't do that here. So it falls on one or two people. And the bigger the project, the more likely it is to be two people. So there is that redundancy.
Okay, makes sense. But actually, that's a great place to wrap with understanding that our business can become far more resilient when we have more team members, a greater diversity of projects, a greater brain pool involved for innovation. But it does take some management, and it sounds like you really have a good handle on understanding the personalities and the work styles of the people who work with you so that everyone can come together as a team. So well done, and thank you so much for being with us here today, Jonathan.
Thank you, Nina.
And thanks to you for tuning in today. You know, I really want you to have a breakthrough in your business as well. So as a loyal listener, I want to give you free access to one of my special video trainings that I call Ignite. In this Ignite webinar, I share my quick growth scale formula that lets you bust through the plateau, design a self-sustaining business, and live the life you deserve. You can get free access by going to businessexponential.com/BBIgnite. Again, that's businessexponential.com/BBIgnite. Go there now, and we'll see you on the next episode of Business Breakthrough.